I want to do with you this morning to start out is to give you a beginning of a story and then ask you to create scenarios for it. That is, how would you end this, or how would you explain the event? I'm not sure that this is original with me. I suspect it is not, but I cannot get a concrete reference for it, so if it sounds familiar, great. Maybe you can help me out to where I got it. But I got it someplace in the distant places of my skull, I suppose. Oh, good. You want to try it out?
I don't think I can do it without being by the door, but Please go on. Not attracting any attention.
What if you fall? Yes. I don't see how you think we would miss you.
Well,
there's a way of taking it out over here.
I'll walk over there.
All right. You know, this is all being taped for posterity, so that the people who come in next week will know just exactly what happened here and think that this is an event. We do have matches.
This wood is a little wet.
All right. We're going to see the veteran Girl Scout do this.
The campfire girl.
Oh, campfire
girl. Say before I start the match that I am working against some rather formidable disadvantages here, and I'm not sure that this is going to work, but I'll try.
All right, you're doing very well so far.
While she's working, may I say that the watercolors, which were just put up around the edges, are good. I hadn't thought of the parallel, but I was thinking of how hard it would be for me to paint watercolor, because it is kind of total perception. Mm-hmm. You don't work with defined borders as you're doing the poppies. You really work with impressions. And they are really, they must relate to the other part of the brain as well.
They don't allow for sharp categorization. I was watching Katie do some of these the other day, and seeing what she did to pick up the different blends of the greens and the oranges. We have to realize. I'm sure we're going to.
Just let it go. If it can't.
What do you think, Paul?
You should. Take this one and set it up in the kitty corner.
Well, there goes the fire.
Don't kill it.
All right, we won't kill it.
We did.
No, it's gone.
Okay.
But it has to pick up that little draft. Well, okay, we're about ready. We are now protected, and I think we thank you very much. We're going to have to see what happens with it. Okay, well, let me give you the beginning of this, and let's see what we can pick up as a completed scenario for it. It's not a complicated story, but you'll have to pick up the details as you hear it. I'm going to read it exactly as it was written at 6:30 this morning. As Betty Thompson opened the door to her boss's office, she stopped short in horror when she found her idolized employer locked in a passionate embrace with the chairman of the board. Sickened, confused, heartbroken, she quietly closed the door behind her as she simultaneously battled with tears, with hot tears and nausea. Anyone want to try a scenario on that one? What happened? By the way, there's no... I didn't have time to complete the story, so you complete it in any way you wish. Anyone give a... Yes, I'll be glad to. Glad you said that. It takes in those... fills in those empty spaces of thought here. As Betty Thompson opened the door to her boss's office, she stopped short in horror when she found her idolized employer locked in a passionate embrace with the chairman of the board. Sickened, confused, heartbroken, she quietly closed the door behind her as she simultaneously battled hot tears and nausea. I'm sorry if I sound like I'm out of the 19th century with this, but I thought you might kind of enjoy it.
My first thought was that he was probably a homosexual, and that's why she was feeling timid.
Oh.
Otherwise, I didn't like
that. All right. That here she found something about her idolized employer that she didn't know before, and here that the employer was homosexual.
I thought she was in love with him.
All right. No,
wait. You thought what?
What did you say?
She decided that she would resign from Cosmopolitan.
All right. I see some bright little eyes saying, I got an idea. What kind of idea do you have?
Well, my response was on this one, that her employer was female.
Oh. All right, go ahead with that.
I didn't have a response as to why she had the emotions that she did, whether she was in love with the chairman of the board or what it was. That was about the extent of my...
Oh, so her employer was female.
Yeah.
And that being locked in the arms of the chairman of the board would be perhaps a natural thing. It helps business and so on.
That's what Cosmopolitan was, too, by the way.
What about another scenario? Anyone? That's another option,
was
clearly.
Male and she was in love with him.
Say it again.
Her employer was male and she was in love with him.
Yes.
Secretly, and didn't realize she had competition.
Oh, with whom?
With the chairman of the board.
The female
who was what?
Was female.
Oh, now we switch the other way around. It's possible that the chairman of the board could have been female. Well, why not?
That's the first thing. The only reason that would make me sick is if I were in love with the one who was suddenly, obviously, in love with someone else.
Would you like to tell us more about you? All right.
Hey, look, it's starting.
Well, build fires can be metamorphical as well. Right, that's a possibility. What else?
Well, I think probably Betty is lesbian and her employer is too, of course. And she's disturbed because her employer has decided to go straight. So
yes, what about that kind of relationship? Not, it's a possibility. You notice that nothing that was said here, how carefully one can construct this, nothing that was said would preclude exactly what you're saying, nor what you were saying. Or can any of you think of another scenario that would end? Please, Paul.
I assume the employer is female, and not really the chief executive of the business, and she's admired very much as a woman who has succeeded, and now she's nauseated about it.
Oh, yes. That she climbed the ladder by sleeping around, you know, choosing her partners. Oh, very good. I mean, not morally very good, I'm sure, but it's a thought. It's a thought. So, yes, you have another scenario?
I think Betty's employer is male, and he's supposedly happily married, and she was horrified to discover that her employer was human. And
even though he's happily married, he proved that this other woman. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to play the game? Isn't it a marvelous game to play, though? It's absolutely... I'm sure this is part of the reason that many of us love to read detective stories. I'm sure... Sigvi doesn't have this tape recorded too. That the marvel of reading an Agatha Christie novel or with Hercule Poirot. I just love this little Belgian guy, if you know, or any of the Dorothy Sayers stuff, is that you come to circumstances where you're bringing your assumptions to it and you have the solution to it, you think, and all of a sudden you see it from quite a different point of view, quite a different kind of set of assumptions. I brought this along. It wasn't hard to find, but you all can see that it is indeed a common construction brick. This thing has a little bit of a history in terms of psychological research, and I just thought for the kicks of it I'd bring it along. It happened to be good. I could have brought other things along. I happen to use a tin can in my dissertation, so but this is what difference does it make? We have a brick. What kind of uses can you see for it? Or what kind of uses can you bring to this? How would you use a brick?
Oh,
anyway, just say it out.
Hold the door open.
Hold the door open, yeah.
You put three candles in.
Yeah, you can put three candles in this one, can't you? Mary.
Build a bookcase.
Build a bookcase.
Put it in the garden and a pansy in each hole.
Put it in the garden with a pansy in each hole.
Put it in your toilet and save a little water.
Save a little water. Come on.
But they disintegrate.
Oh, they disintegrate.
Water erodes.
So we got a rotten toilet going for us. Well, you could seal it, I suppose, and then put it in the toilet. I put some sort of seal around it.
Remember Felix the cat, or who was that that used to throw the brick at the policeman?
Oh, yeah, you would use it as a weapon. Brick bats as weapons, you know, it's a, yeah.
Could build a house.
Could build a house if you had enough of them, sure. What else? Have we exhausted all these possibilities already?
Paperweight. Newspapers from blowing away.
Keep your newspapers blowing away.
Behind your car, the tire, so your car doesn't
roll. Yeah, all right. Keep your car from rolling when you're jacking up the chimney tire.
Could use it in a classroom.
If you got hostile students. For what?
As an exercise in our discussion.
You hit me right between my pedagogical techniques. And ooh, that hurt. What else could you use it for?
Weightlifting?
Yeah. Weightlifting? All right, sure.
How about construction?
What?
How about construction?
Like what? Someone said a house before.
A house, yeah.
You have something else? What?
Edging for
lawns.
Patio.
A what?
For the
fast runners, let them carry this around their waist and see how well they do. You know,
it could be first base.
Could be first base. Sure. Or it could even be second base. I think.
Or third.
Or third, better yet, because it's got the symbolism going for it, doesn't it? The front of a birdhouse. Oh, for goodness sakes. A three-level birdhouse, as that matter of fact, for at least wrens or something like that. Come on, I want to really get you as adventurous. Say something, even if it sounds absolutely silly, say it.
Sidewalk.
That's not even silly, that's pretty good. What?
Drowning unwanted kittens. Drowning your unwanted kittens.
Oh, of course, drowning your unwanted kittens. Don't you see it there? What else? Yes.
How about in Midsummer Night's Dream, there's an imaginary wall.
Yes.
Curb, is this being talked to?
Talking to. Yeah. Maybe this was the part of the wall where they talked to. Dost thou hear me? You know, and all that sort of thing. I don't know whether they would say dost thou anymore, but you can do it nowadays if you want. Sure. A dost thou.
Come
on.
Say it. Tie a helium balloon.
Tie down a helium balloon. Sure. Good idea.
You could break it and use the pieces as drainage in the bottom of a pot.
Oh, okay. Yes, you could break it up and use it as drainage material. Very good.
Counterbalance.
What?
Counterbalance a pulley.
Counterbalance a pulley.
Break a window.
Great way to get rid of some hostilities. Break a window. I don't know if it's a great way, but it's a way of... What?
Paint it.
Yes, you could paint it. Object of art. Carve it. Yeah, you could carve it.
Use it as a rhythm instrument?
Use it as a what?
Rhythm instrument.
Use it as a rhythm instrument, I guess, having bang against...
Or hit it with a stick.
Good.
Something that...
Or hit it with a stick, get some sound out of it, or bang it against something tin, maybe, you know, like a pot or whatever the case may be.
Clean your shoes. Scraper.
Scraper. I don't know if any of you were keeping count, I certainly was not, of how many different categories there were involved in terms of the use of a brick. like a category of weight or a category of construction or a category of weaponry. We had a number of different categories. What's this all about? We give you a story, a lurid beginning, a brick. Any moral to this that any of you picked up?
Aren't you asking for our interpretation?
Yeah, I guess I'm asking for your interpretation. Okay, I'm asking for your interpretation. I suppose another way of saying it in academese would be I'm asking for your assumptions. I was asking, what did you assume about this? I think the obvious assumption here is, oh, it's a brick, it's used somewhere to construct things, and then we can make variations off of that. But can we jump to the improbable category? Can we make improbable associations, even associations that might be called silly or ridiculous? The point of it is that any experience that we have is capable of having more than one meaning. And yet, what happens to us in terms of living, perhaps our lives as we go along, is that we tend to bring the meanings that have been most comfortable to us to the event. Those that have worked best for us, those that worked, according to at least one guy, that give us the best prediction and control over our daily living, that we like to control our life. And we found ways of doing it, of controlling our life, by using perhaps the assumptions that have worked. The problem is that that can have a limited kind of joy to it, finally. There is a time when perhaps when we've worked with our assumptions, especially presumably on the analytic side of things, that there comes an end to the happiness, or at least to the satisfaction that we have in terms of dealing with our lives in an analytic way, which works very well for mastery of the material world. But when we've done that, when we've gotten to the end of that role, when we've finally made it, let's say, economically, in terms of our financial arrangements, when we've made it in terms of providing the necessities for our children, there comes a time when we again ask that question, is that all there is in terms of living this life? When we begin to find our lives having limited satisfactions, that question begins to haunt us and begins to create possibilities even for breakdown. I said last Monday, though, that I was going to take a little different diversion and perhaps get you into this again. I find that in some days I think very well. I think very sequentially. I can hang things together. And other days, I find it difficult to add one word to the other and make some good sense. Maybe today is the day that I feel like that, because I was doing a very holistic experience this morning. I was washing great big pots after breakfast, and somehow my head didn't come into good congruence with the topic at hand. But I did make a promise on Monday that I was going to say something about race in terms of these two modes of thinking. More for illustration than for tolerance. I think each of us has got to work that through ourselves individually and come to grips with the notion of the racial prejudices perhaps that we bring and operate by on a day-by-day basis or on a person-to-person basis. A number of years ago, there was a fellow by the name of Arthur Jensen. Arthur Jensen came out of the University of California context at Berkeley, and he made a rather devastating pronouncement back in around 1969. He maintained that there are racial differences in the way that we process this world. And the racial differences that he was talking about fundamentally focused on blacks. He said they think differently, and I have evidence indeed that they do. Now, you can imagine, this was 1969, right at the height of racial awareness and anger. The anger over Vietnam also had its corollaries with anger over other things. Racial injustice certainly was one of them. It was a year after Martin Luther King was assassinated. And this man, a respected scholar, an educational psychologist, as a matter of fact, out of Berkeley, came through with the notion that much of what we were trying to do in Head Start programs and other catch-up kind of programs, which we've all said were functions of cultural gaps, that this was a matter of not having an enriched environment, early environment in the lives of the children, that if they came from homes where, for example, a literature was not available or appreciated, or where just simply reading material was not available, that had to be compensated for in some way. And the Head Start program was fundamentally an effort to develop compensatory kinds of education, give the kids a lot of concrete experiences, begin to relate it as much as possible to the verbal, and hopefully, and we pray hard, by the time they're 6 years of age and ready to enter first grade, they may be on some sort of a parity with the other more fortunate kids who came from culturally enlightened homes. Well, Jensen came out and he said, no, that's not true. He said, basically, the way we process the world is different, and he felt that there was a genetic base to it. Now, that genetic base was something also we were talking about, too. Do you have, finally, with the people who have not experienced a verbal heritage, as it were, do you have some sort of a genetic inbreeding here that finally gives them a capacity to process the world, perhaps in images and in metaphors that are part of their genetic inheritance, not only their cultural learning as after they've been born, but that is part of their genetic inheritance. And Jensen felt very strongly that indeed this was the case. Likewise, the other side. Is there something possible, is it possible for us to conceive that the verbal thing, the verbal facility, is also an inherited facility? Now, this was an absolutely outrageous notion 20 years ago when the behaviorists were strongly in command. But since that time, there have been some remarkable theories advanced. One of them, in terms of linguistics, has been advanced by an MIT linguist by the name of Noam Chomsky. And Chomsky says the capacity to deal linguistically, verbally, with our world is an inborn event. In this respect, that language capacity is inborn. I was up in Minneapolis around just shortly after Jensen's article appeared in the Harvard Educational Review of spring of 69. He appeared at that convention, I think it was the American Educational Research Association, as one of the invited speakers. And that room, you can well imagine, was about the size of the Village Center, was jammed and with hostile people. How dare he propose that there was a genetic base? Now, what Jensen did, however, was to say, now let's be careful about this. When I say that this might be a genetic thing, I am not making a decision or a judgment or a pronouncement that one is a superior mode of processing this world and the other is an inferior one. That's a social determinant. We in our society, Western civilization, have come to an enormous evaluation or a value placement of the analytic, the linear, the causality, the determination kind of thing, causal determinism. We've put a great stress on that because it's worked. It's done great things for us. It's given us a remarkable philosophy, or at least a philosophical base. As I mentioned before, it's done tremendous things for our theology in terms of unraveling things in an analytic way. What would we do without this? What would Walt do without it? It's a great, great tool. It's done great things also for our plumbing, as I mentioned, that we would not have the plumbing. We would not have the electric lights around here. We wouldn't have the dynamos that run the electrical system unless we had also this kind of thought processes. So we have assigned a high evaluation on it. But that does not mean that other cultures have also. Nor does it mean that we are thereby, although it might be argued, totally incapacitated from learning how to appreciate what it means to think in different modalities than the way that we do. Jensen called these things, said there are roughly two kinds of thinking, one which he called the transformational, which that shouldn't bother us too much. But the transformational, basically, is the kind of stuff that Jerome Bruner is talking about when he says when we go back on our experiences and give them more powerful modalities for the building up of theory, for the building up of generalization, more and more generalizability back onto that which we have learned. We can begin, we go back on our experiences, we continue to build them up on a transformational way, and we get powerful systems. It could not have happened that Einstein could have given us relativity unless he went back on his experiences and reconceptualized them, did them over again in even more powerful ways, so that we have ways of dealing with our universe that are remarkable, simply remarkable. The other kind of thinking is what he called associative. And the associative thinking was, how do we deal with a whole lot of inputs at one time? And I was trying to think of ways of concretizing that. But, and the best way I can think of it is this. I am a lousy dancer. I am in my 50s and I don't know how to dance. Whenever Phyllis and I get on the dance floor at a good wedding, oftentimes German, we feel a little embarrassed. We like hugging each other, that's very nice, but we don't know how to hug and move our feet at the same time.
It's tricky.
Oh, it is tricky. And I thought the whole game was really solved for us when someone said, there's a such a thing as a box step. Box, oh yeah, 1, 2, 3, bum, bum, bum. Yeah, by George. And sure enough, you know, it's like learning how to walk. You're thinking yourself through walking, lift left foot, and then put it down, and then put the left, right foot right down, and the left foot, and that's about the way we dance, too. You know, it was a little less than grace exhibited on the floor. What was happening here was that there was a way of trying to think through an event or a performance, a behavior, that simply was not amenable to thinking through. I play the piano, not very well, but whenever I sit down and I listen to some great jazz pianist, it almost breaks my heart. There are a few things that almost break my heart, but that's one of them. When I hear Ramsey Lewis play, when I hear Oscar Peterson do what he does, I could almost weep for wanting to be able to do that. Or whenever I hear a great jazz at any level, it just makes me yearn. There are very few things that make me yearn. I mentioned one of them just before, but this jazz makes me yearn. Is it possible to think, back to this race issue, and here I'm inviting you to explore areas that I'm entering into. I have not read any of this. I'm not proclaiming that I'm the discoverer of this, by no means. Indeed, there might be some scholarly investigation. I don't know of it right now, but I'm sure as soon as I get home, I'm going to find a whole bunch of it and say, oh, here, they've done this all before you got there. But are there modalities that that could also be in genetic, possibly racial? Well, of course, it would have to be then also that, I suppose, that allow certain enterprises to be done much better than others. Have you ever found, for example, I think of jazz as one of the great ones. I think of movement as another, the dancing, any kind of dancing that is not only thought out or choreographed, but also the improvised dancing. I think of another thing that seems a little bit less related to it, but which came in the back door on me, because I remembered it in the research, but I didn't make the application. And there's a great neurosurgeon up in Canada by the name of Penfield. And Penfield did a lot of research in terms of opening up people's skulls and then giving them slight little electrical stimuli to see what they would do with them. He apparently got them either under very light anesthesia or under hypnosis. You can do that. You can hypnotize people and open up their heads. It sounds kind of ghastly, but it's possible, and it has enormous advantages to it, especially since neurosurgeons are notably probers. They're not quite sure how far they should cut, so they cut a little bit, and then they may wake up the patient and say, would you mind doing this? Can you get sensation in your middle finger? Yes, I have sensation. Thank goodness I didn't cut too far. All right, now go back to sleep. And then they go back and they continue to cut. Well, there's an enormous advantage to having people under hypnotic influence while one is doing this. Penfield did this either under hypnosis, by hypnosis, or by light anesthesia, and he had, as he had person conscious, he would probe different parts of the brain for this. And he came out with enormously productive research, some of which seem to indicate and fold right into what we're dealing here, that there are certain neural connections that finally play out at ages that we may not like to admit. We oftentimes think our physical height might be around 18, 19, or 20, but as a point in fact, there are some things that are closed off to our experience much earlier than this. One of them is the capacity to deal with foreign languages. Learning foreign language, for example, on the secondary level, probably, and I think Penfield's research pointed to this, is probably something that should just as well be forgotten. I know that we have commercial companies who say, well, we can teach a person how to do it by total immersion into that language, and we can indeed do it. But that total immersion series is quite different, or system, I should say, is quite different from the kind of analytic processes that we went through in our secondary experience, our high school experience, learning German. I can remember the dreary hours that we used to spend in German classes learning declensions, cases, and all the forms of the verb. It just went on and on and on. And at the end of three intensive years of German in high school, I didn't know how to speak German. I felt very uncomfortable with it as anything except an event that could be analyzed. I took it as part of my degree program, German, but that was because someone gave me a passage to translate, and I could translate that. See, I knew enough of the vocabulary, and I could figure out that peculiar syntax, you know, or the unique syntax of German, and I was able to do it. But if someone would start greeting me in German, I could also understand that because I could take it apart and extract its meaning. But for me to respond in German was like asking me to respond in a jazz modality on a given theme. I could not do it. My processes weren't simply related to that. And that kind of thing, being slowed down by your verbal processes instead of being helped by them, is the thing I'm up to. Have any of you had any kind of experiences like that, where you've been slowed down by your verbal processes and not able to learn a thing as well? Okay. Where trying to think yourself into it simply didn't do it. Simply didn't do it. Yeah.
I'm just thinking of the difference, although we've spoken of this together, but the difference between our first and second child. Our first child was extremely verbal and learned to swing and to skip by the description of the event, just as you were saying. We described when you lean back and when you lean forward in order to swing, and he taught himself that on the basis of hearing the word. And the second one, who really was much more nonverbal and just did everything naturally, he just looked at it and there it was. And was able to do impossible things just by watching someone else do it.
And it's a little of our personal experience with this particular modality. Yeah.
I teach a craft here that I'm going to probably teach this week sometime.
Yeah.
It's a Japanese folding, but it's with ribbon. And it's very interesting to see the people that teach that class, because if they try to take notes on the steps, they can't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
If they stop and try to analyze it, they have to watch and just do what I do.
Yes.
And it's very much based upon how well you can see rather than how well you can...
Interestingly enough, the research that they've done on this, remember that having these little electrodes on your head, they say they can detect certain activity patterns when you're doing certain things, and one of them is crafts. But I began to think about this last night when I was helping Phyllis with weaving, and she said, would you just simply read those and I'll be able to go much faster. So I was reading one after another, which pedal for her to push and whether it was a light or dark thread. And at that point, I began to think, was this left hemisphere or right hemisphere? What would you guess?
You reading it, or?
Yeah, am I reading it and her responding to it?
Left.
It seemed to me as lineal, and at least in that, it was a kind of a causality. You do this and you'll get that. But it's not quite the same in terms, at any rate, I began to make the distinction in my own thinking, again, between what do we mean by crafts here? There are certain crafts that I'm sure the left half of the brain is going to be going, puckata, 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 and that's basically on the recipe level. And that is, if you follow the recipe, you will get this. That's causality. It's not really creativity. As much as I like to say that weaving is a creative event, it is not a creative event in terms of following the recipe. But crafts can be, and weaving can be, for example, if you create your own patterns.
If you create your own patterns.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, please.
I was struck last night with all of the younger kids who play piano.
Yeah.
But I wondered about, is her name Becky? Mm-hmm. Who had her own composition.
Ledbetter, yes.
Yeah, striking.
Yeah, yeah.
Composition. From someone who presumably has not had music theory, I don't know.
I was wondering about that myself.
Might not have gone about it that way, even if she had.
Yeah.
But it would not musical composition done in a certain way represent...
Yes.
You could do it through linear thinking and sort of follow the rules, but you might sit down and compose something which had much more appeal about it than where you were instructed by something else.
Has anyone here taken theory of music in terms of chords or anything like that?
No.
And were you ever given a line, a melodic line, in which you were supposed to create the chords for it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Any of you are any good at it?
No.
Did you come out okay? It came out enough so that you said, yeah, that sounded good. That sounded good. And that can be, that can also be in a certain sense a kind of an analytic exercise too, because you're dealing with kind of rules, aren't you? You know, you don't move from this kind of chord structure to that. It doesn't sound right. You avoid parallel fifths. At least that used to be the thing when I took harmony. Avoid parallel fifths. They don't sound great. Or avoid parallel fourths. And now all of a sudden you hear the Eastern music, and you find little eight tonalities instead of quarter or half note tonalities, and you find all the little in-betweens there, and it begins to whiz around in your head. And this whole structure that I was taught was rather sacred in terms of Western music comes tumbling down. Yeah, Betsy, please.
I thought the contrast of that was Judy on Saturday night when she said she'd sit down and three melodies came to her from her guitar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Wasn't that remarkable? Yeah, that those... sorry that may not have been a generalized experience for all of you. We had Judy Grossfeld, who's now left the village, give a concert of, fundamentally, it was mostly her own music.
Yeah.
And it was a thrilling thing to see a creative mind at work, as it must be for all of us to see this kind of thing happening, which could not, have you ever thought that this must be some of the, even though it all takes a common theme, or at least there are six of them that take a common theme, that has to be the farthest thing from painting by numbers. Now, I don't want to embarrass anyone who has found much joy and satisfaction in painting by numbers, or on the other hand, embarrassing anyone who has done weaving by numbers. But it is fundamentally a different kind of an event. This is a different kind of event, so dramatically different from painting by numbers. Yeah.
Don't statistics show that musicians can go on creating throughout their lifespan? You know, you go on into your 80s if you're a musician, whereas like physicists peak around like 35.
Yes,
or so,
that is right.
And they dwindle. So you get the idea that the right hemisphere continues to grow.
Yes, there have been studies in saying what kinds of things have been happening here. Are there qualitatively and quantitatively different kinds of thinking processes that hopefully and thankfully can go on beyond 35, you know, since I happen to be beyond that, I'm glad it's true, but that there are other things that are foreclosed. One thing I'd be careful about, though, is to say that the right hemisphere is not being used up to the age of 35 on some of the great creations from physicists, because we do know that indeed there have been jumps. And maybe it is that the intensity of the experience is more than can be borne, and so we shift into larger areas which, where we can find ourselves a little bit more comfortable room instead of the tight discipline categories that are forced upon us by the nature of mathematical enterprise
your
or physics.
Your physicist becomes a philosopher.
Yes, right. And as a point in fact, this is what also oftentimes happens. And I don't think it was also an accident, incidentally and coincidentally, that Einstein was also as familiar for his pipe and for his violin. You know, can't you remember Einstein with his violin? That you almost think that this was the way that he could rest that enormous mind of his, that enormous potential, that he had found different ways of doing it. Norm Nagel told me an interesting little anecdote when they had Martin Marty over on the day of commencement at Valparaiso, that Martin Marty welcomed the time just to get away from a little bit of the crowd and asked for this, Betsy, I'm sure this is all right. He asked for a bedroom, didn't he? He has a little thing that he puts next to his ear that wakes him up in 10 minutes. But what he does during this time, and also, or alerts him that 10 minutes is up, and also has taught his boys, is that the best way to recoup your losses, and he does this about 3 times during the day, is to lie down and do not think word at all, think images. Or not think images, if that's a bad term, since thinking is so often locked into the analytic mode, but just do images. It's almost like a disciplined yoga event, although there they ask to exclude all things and bring it to an intense focus on one element, which presumably leaves out a lot of the garbage that most of us are processing consciously or unconsciously, since we have different threshold levels of, I don't know how to say that in any other way except a kind of a jargonese way, but we do have different threshold levels. Well, where if we can just keep the words from coming up to the threshold level and dealing with images, there is an enormous refreshing element involved in the 10-minute exercise like that, spaced a number of times throughout the day, rather than what most of us would just love to do, and that is take a midday nap, which, by the way, is also a good idea. Just simply letting the world, letting the sensation level, which most of us unconsciously process, let that get away from us. Just push it away, so that we're not dealing with sensations, many of which we will not allow to come up to our consciousness, but nevertheless that are penetrating us. And you know that can happen, where you can do many things on a sensate level, just having it fed into you, where you're not even thinking of it. How many times, for example, have you driven a car and you have been thinking of entirely different things, yet have driven the car effectively and safely, or have done other things without? Well, we oftentimes forget that those sensations are ramming at our door constantly, and we have to find some way of getting a relief from them. And one of the ways might be the cultivation of a different way of processing the world. Many people find enormous relief in this kind of enterprise, in any kind of the creative expression, because it offers that necessary counterbalance to what's happening in oftentimes unconsciously.
What I found interesting about Marty's statement was, because of course he's very brilliant and his children vary.
Yeah.
That he's taught all of his kids to do that.
Isn't that something?
So that you don't have to have a Marty mind to be able to do it.
Yeah.
Which is hard.
It's something like rest stops for the consciousness, isn't it? You know, because we forget that also our consciousness needs rest stops, and before we find that our spring is wound so tightly. Well,
may I ask one more thing?
Yes, please.
How do you bring Jensen up to date? Because unfortunately, your comment about the dancing brings into that whole terrible cliche about they have rhythm. Remember that?
Oh yes, yes, I know.
How do you bring that up to date on educational expectations?
Well, some have better rhythm than others.
Do we expect less from a certain race than in terms of verbal?
See, the notion of saying "do we expect less" means do we expect less on our terms? On our terms. I don't want to evade the question, but indeed, the modality might be a different kind of modality that, it might be misplaced expectations, which would be one strategy of responding to your question.
We rewrite the achievement gap?
No, we just expand our own range of what we accept as valid ways of dealing with the world. I'm often the bridge for this. I have a number of friends who happen to be black, and who talk to me and talk with me on one level, oftentimes my own. I guess that's an indication that I'm not as flexible as they. And then when a friend of theirs comes, that they haven't seen for a while, comes into their range, the rhythms begin to change. I can hear the rhythms, and I can hear the different sounds, and I realize all of a sudden that he has deliberately excluded me from that, saying, you really don't understand this. You don't understand the way I'm talking, because the way I'm talking is this, it's a rhythm, and I got words, and the way of playing with the words is not necessarily cognitive, but it's sensual. It's a fascinating way, and something that I'm fascinated by, and I can see a validity to it, but it's not a validity on an analytic way. Now, can you please understand this? I'm not saying that because you're born black, you're incapable of analytic thought. That is nonsense. Of course you are. Just because you're born white, you can't play jazz. You know, that's silly too. But the notion of confronting this idea, could there be a genetic component that liberates ways of processing this world? And I wish I could find a different way of saying that. That we have not appreciated in terms of its own validity.
I've got a good example. Having to do with black. Mm-hmm. One of the children that I teach has a creative mind that I'll never match. He does two-dimensional, three-dimensional things, you know. That it's fantastic for a little 10-year-old. Yet, IQ shows up in the 80s somewhere and can't process any kind of thinking. He's learned to read and can read words, but to process the understanding of that and to analyze what's going on and it's just beyond him. And of course, math is practically impossible. He has no delayed recall for remembering facts at all. Mm. And so he's failing in school miserably. And we have no way to say, hey, this guy has real talent. He doesn't have to have an IQ. And, you know, we just have no way to process this guy in the system that we have. A fantastic little boy who is just being destroyed, really, by our system.
That kind of depressing thing, I'm afraid, has got too great a frequency happening with it. I'm not a Shakespeare expert, but there are certain things that he said that absolutely have not matched anyone else's, that is in relationship to this, that it always has fascinated me when he talked about the native you of resolution being sicklied o'er by thought, how well that fits this particular thing, that is when we are tempted to deal on an impulse level, we think about it, and all of a sudden, it's sickly, or we don't want to, after I think about it, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to, for example, punch that guy right in the nose when that's all he absolutely needs, is a punch in the nose. Well, that's fine. You know, I'd hate to, I'm sure I've been the beneficiary of some of that checking enterprise already. But we begin, we seem to perpetuate the notion of so checking our impulses, because we don't perhaps, well, for socially acceptable reasons, that's true, we should perhaps check our id. Freud used to talk about the difference between a primary process and a secondary process. What he was talking about in the primary process was very much right hemisphere stuff, and he called it primary process. And he said it was kind of id-oriented. The gorilla in us got up there and began to, you know, we began to live on what Jung would call a sensate level. You know, I love it. Slobbering, let's get our immediate gratification. Well, we come across and we socialize it. We say, watch it, gorilla. You may not get your immediate gratification. You've got to check yourself. I mean, you can't knock her over the head and drag her off into the nearest whatever you drag her off to. No. Think about it. And we begin to bring a tremendous overlay of emphasis on the checking process, on what Freud called the secondary process, where we think it through, and as we think it through, what happens to us is that we become, how can we say it? We become, in a sense, emasculated, that's not a good word. We lose our power, we lose our penetration, we lose our energy. And what all of these people are saying, whether it's Freud or whether it's the research in split brain or whatever it might be, is can you learn how to deal with your impulses in a profitable way? Can you learn how to deal, not to mistrust your feelings? Can you learn that? Can you learn not to mistrust your impulses? Because much of what is happening down there in the id or the gorilla or whatever you might say, and I hate to make this too much of a compartment. I understand that that's faulty philosophically, and I agree with it. But that which is the sensate with us, can we still get the benefit of the creative response, the spontaneity of living, the zest for life that this offers us without sickling it or so much by our thought that what happens is that we successfully sterilize it and begin to lead the most bland, conventional, predictable lives which have no kick in it. It doesn't have a kick because we always think, I got to check myself. How do we come into contact with this? How do we do it? Yeah, please.
It seems like it's the difference between the Scandinavian and the Italian. We as Scandinavians will do that, you know, we check ourselves. The Italians seem to live, their emotions are right on the surface and they let them out.
Oh, yes.
They don't check them at all. Oh. And I think even in our third and fourth generation, we can see that difference.
Oh, we try to get ourselves into this a little bit, and it's marvelous. One of the best things that happens up here at Holden is that we learn to hug strangers, you know, which is very nice. We're not quite at the Italian level, and we have marvelous Italian neighbors who have been expanding our consciousness. We have not here at Holden gotten to the pinching level quite yet, but I think we're probably a far way down the path from that. But to say pinching, you know, this is almost like the Roman, in Rome, where the young ladies are afraid to walk down the street for being pinched by an appreciative Italian male. Well, maybe we won't want to go that far, but may I submit to you that the notion, at least, is not all that bad. It's not all that bad that we can say, you are pretty, my dear, but we can say that in a number of ways. At least they found there was a way of saying it by, you sure are, without using one word at all. And yet she gets the message, you know, she says, oh, I'm desirable at least someplace.
I think there's a whole danger here in contrasting, making this contrast between impulse and reflection. Because
Paul.
Between impulse
and
then reflective action.
Yeah, all right.
Because so often the impulses that we receive are already heavily screened. You see, there are people who will say that to act on your impulses is to be spontaneous. I don't think that's really satisfactory. It depends upon how perceptive an impulse receiver you are.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if this is hitting the guy in the nose, or pinching a woman, mm-hmm. I suspect that in both of those cases, the impulse to do that is a product of some prior screening process. We get a more adequate apprehension of the world, that we wouldn't have that anymore.
That is a good observation, and it's right. We do have gating processes here. We have sieves already that allow allowable things within us that have allowed certain things to come up to our consciousness, and we still have not dealt with what about unconscious levels? Unconscious things that we have not, we've tamped down sufficiently, and of course this sounds terribly Freudian, but that we have kept so far down that we haven't even allowed them up to conscious level. I want to mention another one, but let's, Nyla.
Well, can you follow through then with what you're saying, that using the example of pinching is genetically Italian? I mean, is that part of the room?
It sure would be a marvelous excuse, wouldn't it?
Genetically Northern European?
No, I'm a little leery about that, because that's it's a social allowable, isn't it? You know, that
right.
your society there says, okay, that's okay, we understand it. You know, the pinch is kind of universal language within our society. I don't know, I wouldn't be able to unscramble that one for you.
I really have problems then with your saying that your friend who speaks to you changes the speech when one of his friends comes around as being genetic.
Oh.
Well,
you could grab it that it could be,
yeah,
that it could be, well, you grab it that it could be genetic, but that he wouldn't think that it's, or that has been culturally reinforced or socially reinforced, where he would sense that in another sub-social system that it is not reinforced, but it still has a genetic base. I don't think it's logically excluded.
No, but then if I'm going to say that, then I'm going to have to say that the pinching is genetically...
No, not necessarily. I think you could run into some logical snags on that. It can be. Mm-hmm. It could be either genetic or socially originated. Right now, I don't think we need to get hung up as much on the genetic thing right now, because I think that can be... there are a lot of anger-inducing elements about that, especially for any of us who have dealt with on a civil rights level. Yeah, please.
There's a very important question there, though. Some people have said for a long time, one thinks of the philosopher Kant, that there are structures to the mind.
Yeah.
And that these different structures let you apprehend and process the world differently.
Right.
But those people have said that belongs to the human mind as such, and that it's true of all human beings, that there are structures to the mind, and that it's a cultural phenomenon which of them is developed, and which potential is realized, but the potential resides there for everyone. Now the question is whether that belongs to human mind as such, and different cultures, different traditions, simply draw upon one set of potentialities and some others draw upon some others, and then it shows up as differences in cultural behavior, or whether in fact over time the genetic load changes with different cultures.
Yes.
And I mean, that's an important question.
Which is the question that's been raised, for example, on the racial line again, is why is it an accident? Is it just a cultural accident that we find more outstanding black athletes than we do, proportion-wise, than white athletes? What is there a genetic element to that, you know?
Probably partly physical.
Well, has there been an exclusion thing here, or some sort of an elimination that there was a... Sure, it's a physical, but that is genetic.
What is Jensen's evidence? I mean, can he pinpoint
Yes, he can, and almost everything that he has proposed, of course, has had has been met with a controverted, an opposite point of view. But he feels that he has not at all been disproved, and there are a number of he's got substantial support, let's say, also from an element of the academic community that could not in any way be described as racist. This is not the point. To fight off this thing, how to say, can we make honest attempts at looking at genetic differences without having the burden of having our offices picketed, which of course his has. I mean, he has been subjected to to demands by students that he be ousted from his faculty position as a racist, implicit. Well, when we talk about academic freedom, does that allow us also to investigate genetic components of those things which we have previously considered culture cultural determined events. See, and now all of a sudden it gets to us, because a number of us have committed ourselves very much to, for example, equal treatment, civil rights, and all this sort of thing, and on our assumption that there are no differences. And in a sense, this keeps us also from inviting the notion that there might be a genetic difference, because it's going to undercut much of what we think is just and true. And I think this is where Jensen was also found to be very offensive in the nostrils of some of our best white liberals. Yes?
Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting. I heard a male athletic director say that from now on probably we would see fewer black athletes, because that used to be the only way they could make it and get scholarships. And now with fairer means and other scholarships, these really bright guys would say, the heck with that, I don't want to be a jock, I want to be a physicist or a musician.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't have to be a jock now, I'm not putting it down.
Yeah, right.
I can get my college education without being on the football team now.
Yeah. Now that he's gained entry, he doesn't need the athletic thing. Of course, he had other talents. Yeah.
I feel all kind of riled up inside, because I feel like he's...
Yeah.
Anyway, that's the impression
yeah.
I get. Not because of the racial aspect, but because it seems to me that we're talking all around the point, and the point seems to be, is there a separation? Anyway, that's the impression I get, a separation between the creativity and the analytical. And it seems to me that that's just an extended function of the, once you have learned how to do something, it allows you to be creative within that. If you have that freedom to be, and that's a trite phrase, but that goes back to another thing. These are all thoughts that have popped into my head all morning.
Mm-hmm.
I've been bottling them up.
Mm-hmm.
It goes back to a research study that I read once, where there were three groups of children. There were a psychologist took children and divided them, or took them to a birthday party, and the birthday party was just filled with toys and good things to eat and just everything that every child you would think would want to do. And he found that there were three types of children. These were very young children. There was a child that stood and watched and never took part. There was the child that would watch for a while, figure out what he wanted to do, and take part. And then there was the child who would just jump in. And as a teacher, I have found children basically getting into these three types. And as a parent, I have found my own child. My oldest boy is the kind who will stand around and watch for years before he'll jump into anything, and then have to be pushed to do it. And the second child is one that'll watch, and then will go ahead and do her own thing when she feels like it. And it seems to me that I'm wondering if we all come in one of these three fashions into this world, basically somehow, I don't know, genetically coded this way, not a racial way or not anything else, but we bring this into all our whole experiences. I'm a person that would sit back and watch and then jump in, finally, where maybe somebody else is very outgoing and would just go in. And part of it is cultural, part of it is what the home environment that we've been brought up with. And to get along with the racial thing, these are some more thoughts about
mm-hmm.
me. I lived 2 years in British Honduras, which is a black culture, and I lived with a family, a black family, and it was not, I was the minority, I was the only one there, and it took me a long time to feel at home. And we would walk down the streets, and the men on the street corner say, "Hey, baby, you're looking really fine today," or something like that. And at first I go like, "Yeah."
Mm-hmm.
You know? But by the time I got finished being there 2 years and assimilating myself into the culture as much as possible, I found myself answering back, "Oh, you're not looking so bad yourself." You know, somebody I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Or the dancing. I came from a culture and a family and an upbringing where we just didn't dance. went to Concordia College, where at that time there was no dancing except square dancing. Then I went down to a culture where at the birthday parties for the little kids of 2 years old, half of the party is spent dancing with music. And the little ones are dancing around like crazy. It's something that they're brought up with from the minute they're born. And by the time I left, after 2 years, I was a fairly good dancer, as long as I stayed in that culture. Got back here, and I can't dance with anybody even yet. But I'm just an excellent dancer with laughs. Mm-hmm. You know, you learn these things, and there's so much that you can learn, as if you finally let yourself go enough to be able to do it. Again, the watching, and then allowing things to happen.
Here, I think all I would plead for is this, that talking about this being a genetic component does not demean it. Does not demean it. Right, than on a verbal level, but very great on a mechanical level. We don't demean, or at least we hope we won't demean such a person.
Yes, we can't.
All right, we do tend to do that, but all right, let's say then, maybe the question I was trying to get to is, isn't this something that we also must learn how to incorporate into our value systems, that his existence is, in a certain sense, a rebuke to our value systems for not being able to incorporate it. And we have elevated some of these to an almost unconscionable value level. But, I don't know, please.
Yeah, my sociology and psychology are pretty dusty, but when you, I'm not riled this morning for some reason, I must be sick, but you are certainly not implying, when you speak genetically, you're not implying racially genetically. I mean,
Yes, I am.
Are you implying that?
Yes.
Well,
yes. What I am proposing to you is that this research suggests that. And what is interesting about it, the notion of inferiority, for example, is an insidious thing, because we again impose that superiority, inferiority on the basis of the assumption. I'm saying what has to be redeemed here is not whether or not it is genetic, but it must fall back on us and say, what is our system of values? And does this have validity, or indeed, must I be able to change as well?
All right, but I can see that in some cases the genetic factor would be very obvious. You know,
yeah.
I mean, the third and fourth generation legacy,
yeah,
you know, will persist throughout all humanity. All right. However, when you look upon a smaller segment here of humanity, say like the one family, and you see one child who is born with mechanical aptitude, mm-hmm, which is not induced, which is not trained, which is not even encouraged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, we've done nothing to feed this, but a mechanical aptitude emerges, which stems from ancestors whom he has never even met or seen, as opposed to someone else in the family who couldn't nail two boards together if he worked a half a day.
Right.
So, you know, to me, I see the possibility of the racial genetic legacy, but you don't have to limit it to that. It certainly does not imply that it is only genetic. And if it's apparent genetically in one family member, it obviously must be apparent generations and in a larger cross-section of population. I suppose I'm putting that badly, but
no, you're not. I think we're all trying to strive for clarity here, and I think our thinking is. But I have yet to
going
find.
Going back to the, if you would be wise or rare, pick your grandmother with care.
Fine. Yes. Or what?
You know, I'm sorry, I didn't have.
Yeah, you didn't have a choice on it. You just simply had. I have yet to come across any kind of an estimate or a definition of an integrated person, a put-together person, that does not have as a component a capacity to learn and to appreciate the human condition in all levels of expression. Again, I couldn't help but think of this very compelling story that Leo Bustad talked about, going to this place in Germany, the Bethel Valley, and where this brilliant, and he described him as a genius, the director of this whole enterprise, day by day spent time with some of the most severely handicapped of all the residents of that place. And again, I do not think that this was just simply some sort of an altruistic humanitarian benefit that went one way. I think if he was the put-together person that I inferred from Leo's presentation, he was also receiving enormous benefit from being in contact with what society at large would have called a handicapped person, but that he would not have. He said, No, you're misunderstanding. You're bringing a value, an evaluation that is insulting to this person. This is a gift. This person is a gift to you. You can learn great things and benefit greatly from them. See, but in most definitions, we would say, well, maybe we should think of euthanasia. Here's a person who is so badly, badly damaged that from the social point of view, social productivity criterion, maybe we should even consider euthanasia. That's the point, you see, that says, how dare you? How dare you think that way? How can you put a value system on it that would cause you to take that person's life? See? But there are value systems, and of course, in their less virulent level, we have all sorts of things. We don't say, let's put them to death, but let's not let them bubble up to full participation in our society. How dare we? How dare we? Don't you see? There are things, there are valid human dimensions that we have not allowed into our consciousness because, presumably, one way of describing it would be because our assumptions have narrowed the gap so much that we only allow those things that please us to get in there, huh? Mm-hmm. Quick, Carol.
I was going to ask a question about categories. It seems to me that we only measure two kinds of IQ, that's verbal and quantitative.
Yes,
and
yes, right.
Maybe we divide those into subsections.
Right.
But
yeah.
I wonder if there hasn't been something more recently done with new categories.
Indeed, there has. And of all things, they started out in Minnesota, or at least a good number of them started out at the University of Minnesota. there are ways, and thank goodness for them, that they're also expensive. Thank you very much.